We started a new series on the mark of maturity. And the idea behind this series was, what is it in Scripture that sets some key markers, a litmus test, if you want to call it that? What are the things that you can see in a Christian's life that define them or make them or mark them as being mature? And this is somewhat important in our day and age when we have a church that calls itself mature. But anybody that's been in the church for long enough knows there's a whole lot of people who call themselves Christians that don't really live a Christian life. But there's a whole lot of facade. There's a whole lot of things they build to make the appearance of being Christians and being mature Christians. But when you start digging into people's lives, you start to wonder and go, huh, what's really going on? And so we went about this series with the not to make people puffed up, but rather to challenge each other on how can we become mature? What is it? What are the markers? What is the litmus test that actually will sit there and say, yes, this is a mark of maturity? What are things we can aim for? And so Leonard started off last week with an excellent sermon that one of the markers of maturity in a Christian is that mature Christians prepare for when the flood comes, for when the attacks come. They have prepared, they have laid a foundation, they have put on the armor of God, they have set themselves in a place so that when the flood does come, they're not caught unawares. They don't have the ground swept out from underneath them. They do not lose the victory. It's not that a mature Christian never has problems, but they're prepared for it. Not being exposed to attack. This week, I want to start with the word and the name Gehenna. And some people might be familiar with that name, Gehenna, which is a more modern Greek name. The more ancient Greek is Gehenna. Gehenna was a valley south and east of Jerusalem. And the valley at the time of Christ was the place where Jerusalem took all of their garbage, all of their refuse, anything that needed to be burned and destroyed went there, and there was a fire in that valley that never died. It just burnt all everything that needed to die. Now that valley has a very rich and dark history, and every Jew knew the history of that valley. Its notoriety started with King Solomon. King Solomon was a great king until he started to let his wives influence him, and there was a couple of wives that convinced him to allow them to set up an altar in that valley to the Ammonite god Molech. And Solomon allowed that. And then as Israel went into its cyclical pattern of one king came up and they did evil in the sight of the Lord and blah, 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 and they did that over and over and over again, two kings in particular, Manasseh and Ahaz, both these kings were so evil that they actually sacrificed people on those altars in that valley to the god of Molech. And there's even reason to believe that they were so evil that they actually even sacrificed their own children live on those altars to the god of Molech. When Josiah became king of Israel, one of the few bright shining lights, the first thing he did was destroy those altars. And it was Josiah that turned that valley into the garbage dump of Jerusalem. He destroyed the valley, he destroyed the worship, and then he proclaimed that that would be the valley that would forever be known as the place where all the garbage and all the dump would go and it would burn. And that is a dark blight on the history of Israel, and all the Jews knew it. All of that brings us then to my text, that background knowledge. Mark chapter 9, verse 30. I got a long passage, but it's a long story. And I'd like to read it. Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 30. Give everyone a little bit of time to pull out their phones or their Bible, because I think Leonard's the one of the few with an actual physical Bible. Actually, if you're not in the first or second row, third row, oh, hey, we got physical Bibles, right on. Love it. I'm old school. I like the physical Bible. I like a good book in my hand. Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 33. And they being Jesus and the disciples, came to Capernaum. And when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them. And taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but the one who sent me." John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for no one who does a mighty work in my name will soon be able to speak evil of me. For the one who is not against us is for us. For truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a great millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. And if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you that you enter life crippled than with two hands to go to Gehenna, to the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life lame than with two feet to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into Gehenna, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. For everyone will be salted with saltiness, will be salted with fire, Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Therefore, have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another." This story starts with the disciples arguing amongst each other about who is the greatest. And as soon as Jesus confronts them and they don't even have the boldness to admit their shame, and then the rest of this passage is Jesus' teaching in response to the disciples. They argue about who is the greatest, and Jesus goes on this big long teaching and ends with the phrase, "Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with each other." The fires of Gehenna. If you look at the valley and the valley of Gehenna as Jesus saw it, at a very surface level, it served as a point of sanitation. Jerusalem would take its garbage, its refuse, everything that could possibly, by deterioration, cause contamination, corruption, was thrown there and burned. That valley served a purpose. By burning all of that, Jerusalem was kept clean. It was kept healthy. It was kept sound. It was kept whole. The Jews already knew that there was already a spiritual connection to that as well. Through Josiah, evil was burned. And by the burning of the altars and the evil that was done there, by that burning and that destruction, Israel as a people was kept whole and healthy and sound. Jesus then takes it a step further in two ways. One, he says it's not just the nation of Israel, it is you as a person. It is better for things to burn in that fire that you might be kept whole and healthy and well and sound. And then he added the extra twist of the eternity side. It is better for that to burn now than later, if you catch my meaning. And Christ's not so subtle hint. And he says it in this. He said, everyone will burn with the fire of salt. Everyone will burn with that fire and that salt. Salt is good. And have this salt in you. So what do we make of this? Jesus is connecting this valley of fire, this connection with evil and this burning fire. He then calls that same fire salt. He says everyone will be burned with this salt, but also to have this salt in you because this salt is good. My first point is this. The fires of Gehenna that Christ was using as that imagery, that fire, that burning, is the holiness of God. Let the holiness of God burn within you so much so that it consumes the evil tendencies. It consumes our sin. It consumes our drive and desire to sin and to go do everything that we do. Anything that is perishable in our lives, anything that would cause corruption, anything that would bring down our health, let the fires of holiness and that salt burn brightly within you so that you may remain healthy and whole and sound. Let the fire of God's holiness burn within you. Have salt in yourself, because salt is good, and everyone will be salted with this fire. And Jesus goes on to share a couple of things. When he's talking about better to do this, he talks about it is better to, and I'm going to rearrange them, so don't look them in order. It is better to pluck out an eye than it is for you to enter into the flames of hell with two eyes. This passage is a little macabre for Christ. It's a little dark. But the point is this. What is it in your life that inspires you to sin? What is it that you see in your daily walk, when you wake up, when you're out on your own? What is it that you see with your eyes? What is it that first catches your attention and you know that that catches your attention and that will inspire you or cause and raise a desire within you to sin, to go down a path you know you shouldn't go down? Whatever that is, it is better for you to cut that out of your life. Get rid of it. Let it burn. What is it in your life that leads you down that path that you walk down that leads you towards sin? What are the steps? You know what that path looks like. What is it in your life? What are the paths in your life that you know are wrong, but you are prone to walk down? Whatever that is, cut that off. Get it out of your life. Better to get rid of that completely than to end up in hell. Better to cut off your hand. What is it? What are the things in your life that you actually reach toward and grab? The actual deed of sin. What is it? After you have seen and you have walked towards it, what are the things you actually grab and touch that causes you to sin? That brings corruption, that degrades the spirit and the life of Christ within you. Whatever that is, it is better for you to just get rid of it out of your life. Cut it out. Chop it. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16 say this. Do not love the world, nor anything that is in the world. For if anyone loves the Father, the love of the world is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the eyes, the desires of the heart, and the pride of life, these are not from God, but are of the world. Do not love the world. There is a connection between this holy fire of God that burns within us and Jesus' teaching on the greatest commandments. Jesus said the greatest commandments are what? That you love the Lord your God and that you love your neighbor as yourself. But Jesus also said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. There is a connection between loving God and holiness and obedience that cannot be argued against. To love the Lord is to follow him. To follow him is to obey him. We cannot veer from that. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 17 says, the upright, the holy person forsakes the path that leads to sin. But his path leads to wholeness and uprightness and righteousness. The upright person, the holy person, chooses that path. Let the fire, the salt, the holiness, the passionate flame of God burn within you so bright that it will not book terms with evil. No compromise. No terms. Let it burn bright. Let it consume all that is in your life that would lead you, guide you, tempt you. Cut it out. Let it burn all that. So why? That you might remain sound and whole and healthy as the fires of Gehenna did for Jerusalem, as they did for the people of Israel. Let the holiness of God burn. My second point is that if that fire then is burning within us, what is it doing? What is it causing? And I think Jesus was teaching the disciples on two things. As he went through this whole teaching on Gehenna and salt and saltiness and everyone being salted, I think he was bringing it right back up to this whole problem of the disciples at the beginning of this passage. If you go earlier on to chapter 9, you'll read that the beginning of chapter 9, there is Jesus taking Peter, James, and John, up onto the Mount of Transfiguration. And there the three of them behold Jesus in his glory with Elijah and Moses. And then they come down. And wouldn't you know it, they get into an argument about who is the greatest. Is it really that hard to make a connection that the three of them probably came down with an air of smugness? And then all 12 of them get together and they're arguing amongst themselves. Probably all 12 are arguing about which one of the three is the greatest, as they were the ones up that got to see this huge, awesome event. And as they're coming down and they're dealing with that, later on in chapter 9, it says that they came across this man who had a boy that was demon-possessed, that had a mute and a deaf spirit, and the disciples try to cast the demon out, and they can't. So Jesus has to come around, and he does, and then he looks at the whole ground of them, including the father, and says, how long must I put up with this faithless generation? And then they're on the road, arguing about who is the greatest. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. If the fire and the salt of God's holiness is burning within you, that fire will transform our human desire for unbridled ambition and will transform that into a desire to serve. Unbridled, unregulated human ambition. Who is the greatest? I'm the greatest. I mean, and it doesn't matter what it takes for me to become great. I am the greatest. I desire to be the greatest. And God's fire, his holiness, is going to transform that desire, kill it, and will birth instead a desire to serve. And I'm not saying that it's not good to have goals and dreams and ambition. It's not what Christ was getting at either. But unbridled human ambition at all costs to make my name great. This has been a problem of humanity since the dawn of time. Even the Greeks have stories about it. They're warriors. The whole point was to make a name that would last through history, where your name be remembered. Do what it takes for your name to be remembered. We do it in church. There was a season in even my own church history where people receiving prophetic words, and it really was whoever got the prophetic word where God was going to say, "You're going to do great things for Christ, Leonard." And then he would go to the next person, "You're going to do great things for Christ, Herman." Who defines greatness? Because I guarantee you, people sitting in that same role were thinking, "Awesome, God, you're going to call me to Tanzania, and I alone, through your power, am going to transform the whole nation of Tanzania. They are all going to get saved, and I will be remembered throughout history of having done great things for God." And already, we have already set and told God what the standard is for great things. What if God's great things for you is that you're going to clean toilets for the next 30 years, and by doing so, you save somebody who would not have heard the gospel, and that person marries someone and has a kid, and that kid gets saved, and that kid leads somebody else to Christ, and that person goes and saves a nation? Does that equal to your level of greatness? Are you okay with that? Because if we are setting and determining what greatness is, then we've missed the point. Because greatness is not our name, it is Christ's name. And how do we exalt and push the greatness of the name of Christ? We serve. It's not about me. It is about Him. And Christ Himself said, "I, who come from the Father, am not so great that I did not come down here to be served, but to serve." The fire and the passion of God should transform, should destroy unbridled human ambition and turn it into a desire to serve. We harp in this church, quite a bit on serving. We ask, without shame, that everyone come in and serve and help. And we don't do it because we're slave drivers. We don't do it because we want to make everyone's lives miserable and suffer. We don't do it because we want to be unreasonable. We ask it because we believe at the deepest root of our core being that serving is the first step. It is the first thing. It is the first calling of every Christian. We have had people come into this church and ask for ministries. We turn around and ask them to serve. Serve first and see where God takes you. But if you want to come into this church and take a ministry and have a ministry, but you're not going to help serve, I'm sorry. This story now applies. Because the culture of this church is to serve. The Corinthians had this problem. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul is talking to the Corinthians, and he says, "You have this knowledge, and this knowledge puffs you up." And it gives the image almost of this atomic bomb cloud. It's this big poof. And he says, "You guys live way up here in this puffy cloud. You have all this knowledge. You think you're so smart. You have this great, feely, happy Christian experience, but you have no substance." He says, "Your knowledge puffs up, but love builds." Love and serving go hand in hand. You cannot love as a Christian and not serve. Those are opposite ideas. To love is to serve. Love builds a foundation. Love builds community. Love lays the groundwork for something to last for ages and time beyond your life. Love builds. The fire of God should consume so brightly that it transform unbridled human ambition into a desire to serve. Why? Because love builds. And it will build something greater than yourself. It will build a name that is greater than yourself. It will build something that will last ages and decades and hundreds and thousands of years, way beyond when your bones have dried to dust and your name is forgotten. But what you have built by serving in love will last because it is Christ. And it is His community and His foundation. May the fire of God burn so much that your human ambition for greatness is transformed into a desire to serve. My third point is this, that the fire of God will eradicate our sense of entitlement and our sense of exclusiveness and privilege. Continuing on in the same passage, Jesus ends at there, he said, if anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And then he said this, he took a child and he put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. And then we get John pipes up. And at first glance, it could be easy to think that maybe John at this point asks a question. I want to propose a different thing. I think John is actually confessing something. I think John at this point has been rattled. I think John was one of those three up at the top, and John was one of the three that was arguing amongst trying to volley himself for greatness. And then Jesus says, if anyone receives a child in my name. And then John confesses this. And John said to him, teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. And we tried to stop him because he was not following us. But Jesus said, do not stop him. For anyone who is not against us is for us. Do you see the picture here? Not a chapter, even a chapter before. Here is John and the disciples in all of their privilege and standing attempt to cast out a demon and fail. Then they argue about who is the greatest. Jesus pulls a child and says, if anyone receives this child in my name, and John finally clicks, something's not right, and confesses, Lord, we saw somebody not attempting to cast out demons, not thinking about casting out demons. He was actually casting out demons, something he had failed to do with the other disciples. In the name of Christ. And he said, we tried to stop him. Why? Because he wasn't one of us. He wasn't part of this happy, holy huddle. He wasn't our group. He wasn't one of your 12. Jesus, he wasn't with us. Therefore, we tried to stop him. And Jesus said, no. But we do this all the time. We like our happy, exclusive bubbles. We like to feel special. We like to feel privileged. We like to feel honored. And so we create nice, exclusive little bubbles. Entitlement. John and the disciples at that point felt entitled. We are Christ's disciples. You're not one of us. Why are you doing this? We forbid you. And Jesus said, no. We don't have to go too far to see more examples of this. The Jews tried to look at the Gentiles and said, you can't be followers. You're not Jews. You must be Jews. And Christ said, no. And then they said, you need to have the circumcision. You must have this physical mark, otherwise you can't be part of the brotherhood. And Christ said, no. Then the Galatians got this idea. Well, you must have our special knowledge. We have special knowledge. And you, oh, that's a shame. What a shame. You don't have special knowledge. You don't know what we know. Oh, that's a shame. You can't be part of us. Once you get the special knowledge, then you can join us. Oh, isn't it a shame? You're not part of this eldership team. I'm sorry. You can't pray for people. Only people who are elders can have the knowledge and the maturity of Christ to pray for each other. Oh, I'm sorry, you're not married. If only you were married, you could have a ministry and do things for God. Oh, I'm sorry. If only you were born a man. The fire of God, that holiness that burns within us, should destroy our sense of entitlement and our sense of privilege. Instead of creating walls of exclusion, we should be breaking down the walls and opening our eyes to see what God is doing amongst everyone in our midst. We should not be looking just in the corners of our own church. We should be looking across the street and seeing what God is doing in Greenfield Baptist and in Dayspring Presbyterian. And we should be looking and saying, God is moving. God is speaking. God is doing. You are my brothers and sisters. How can we do this together? Instead of saying, oh, I'm sorry. You don't believe in the initial evidence of speaking in tongues? I'm sorry. Obviously, you don't have the power of God to do great things in the earth. You're not part of our happy holy huddle. That's a shame. Instead, let the fire of God burn within you to break down your sense of entitlement and your sense of privilege and to open your eyes to see that all that God is doing in other families, in other homes, in other churches, in this city. And instead of building walls and saying, you're different from me, I'm sorry. No, let us break it down. Let us join together with our brothers and sisters and let us do unbelievable things for Christ. Let us see what Christ is doing in this city and in this nation and in Africa, in South Africa, in Ethiopia, and let us join with them and say, you are my brother and you are my sister. Let us do this for Christ. So what is the mark of maturity? If I can get the band to come up. The mark of maturity that I feel Christ is pushing in this passage as he looked at his disciples and he saw them fail and he saw them struggle. The mark of maturity that the fire and the salt of God's holiness would burn within you, that it would burn so bright that you would make no terms with evil, you would not compromise with evil and with sin. The mark of a mature Christian does not book and compromise with evil. The mark of a mature Christian is that fire then burns. And it destroys that person's desire for ambition and greatness and turns it into a desire to serve. And that fire destroys our sense of entitlement and privilege and opens our eyes to see that all that God is doing. I'll close with this. Jesus said at the end of this passage, have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. He said in another passage in Matthew chapter 5, you are the salt of the earth and the light in the darkness. Have salt in yourself and be at peace with everyone. Amen.
God, there is none.